From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
With bicycles on the increase, is safety on the decline? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. On the eve of another ciclovia, with 10 miles of Los Angeles streets cleared of cars, there's growing tension between bicycle riders and drivers of automobiles. Are hit-and-run incidents on the increase? Was at least one case intentional? We'll hear what the LAPD has to say. Also tonight, a new poll on the LA riot of 1992, 20 years later. What percentage thinks it might happen again? Later on, there might be a drone in your future, like it or not. First, here's the news. We're only back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The President of the Congress envisioned tens of thousands of unmanned aerial vehicles, that means drones, populating American airspace. What are the possible consequences for the friendly skies? Later on, we'll hear about unlimited usefulness as well as safety and privacy. First, Mayor Villaraigosa will introduce what is promised to be a grim Los Angeles City budget next week, based in part on the latest report from the city's chief administrative officer, Miguel Santana. He has warned of a $222 million shortfall next year, and he expects that to almost double the year after that. Miguel Santana, welcome to Which Way LA.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
You don't have any good news to tell us today, I don't think, when you're talking about a prospect like that. One of the things you've talked about is privatizing some of what the fire department does. Tell us how that would save money.
Well, I think, you know, I'm not prepared to say to privatize it. I think what we should do is look at it. Over 80% of the calls that go from the fire department are related to health issues. And in most jurisdictions around the country, those are managed. The transport of individuals from their location to the hospital is managed by a private company. And that, in turn, results in savings for the jurisdictions. You know, it's something we should look at and study and have an independent analysis to determine the way we currently do it is the most effective way. And then from that, make decisions based on that independent report.
Pat McCosker, the president of the Firefighters Union, says that would be a public health disaster. He says that private ambulance crews abandon patients who can't pay, that companies then abandon communities that won't pay. Would it be more trouble than it's worth?
Well, it's currently in place for most of L.A. County. So L.A. City is unique in that we do all of that work ourselves, and the majority of the 87 cities in L.A. County is managed through private ambulances.
And do they do it more cheaply?
Generally, yes, they do it more cost-effective because it's a cost that's not incurred by the municipalities.
Austin Buettner, who's a former deputy mayor who's now running for mayor, says you might be able to cut down the crews that run in the fire crews from 3 to 2. Is there any chance of that?
Well, I think we need to look at everything. I think, you know, part of what this time calls for is to put everything on the table and assess how we've managed our city and re-examine it. And if it turns out that the way we do it is the most effective, both in terms of the service and cost, then we should reaffirm that position. But I think there's nothing wrong with taking a look at all of these issues and ultimately making a decision that makes the most sense for the residents of L.A.
What specific kinds of things? You say there's no one quick fix, but you ultimately have to talk specifically. What do you have in mind, and will there be layoffs? And if so, how many?
Well, I think, you know, the challenge that we're facing is that our expenditures in our four main areas, which is our pension costs, healthcare costs, our compensation for our employees and our workers' comp, are all growing by 4.7% each year. Unfortunately, our revenue is growing by a modest 2.3%. So until those two lines meet, we'll continue to have a structural deficit. So ultimately, the only options that we have are to reduce our expenditures and to increase our revenue. So the combination of those two will ultimately get us to financial sustainability. So in relation to reducing our expenditures, we're proposing and asking that the raises that were committed to the coalition of unions be foregone so that we could generate $50 million of ongoing savings. Those raises were committed during a time that the city was during an economic boom. We were projecting to have a $5 billion-plus general fund by July 1st, 2012. Unfortunately, we're projecting today a $4.3 billion general fund. So clearly there's a gap from what was projected to now. The other areas is having our employees now contribute towards premium of health care. Most city employees receive health care for free. That's simply not sustainable and, frankly, not consistent with most other jurisdictions and certainly the private sector. And then on the revenue side, we even if all of those things get done, we make those changes. On the expenditure side, it's still not enough. And what we need is about $150 million of ongoing new revenue from what we have. And what we're proposing is doubling the documentary transfer tax, which is a tax that you pay when you purchase a home. Most people don't even know that they pay it because it's part of sort of the overall cost of when they buy their property.
Escrow.
And we're below cities in Northern California. We're asking that to be doubled. They'll get it to $9.50 for every $1,000 of the value of your property. And that would generate $100 million of new revenue that could go to deal with our deficit. We're also suggesting increasing the parking tax, which is currently 10%, and we're recommending 15%.
Now, both of those would require a vote by the people, would they not?
That's true, and so the opportunity to have that vote would be in March of next year, the same time that we have candidates for mayor and for city council, and it would require a 50-plus-1 vote. Obviously, these are not easy things to consider, but the public does need to weigh the consequences of not generating this revenue. Our ability to maintain public safety as the city's number one priority will become severely jeopardized. We currently 70% of the dollars that we have discretion over goes towards public safety, and so it's hard to deal with a $222 million deficit, a $340-plus million deficit the following year and in ongoing years without ultimately touching public safety without new revenue.
Okay. We have to make clear these are the proposals of Miguel Santana, who is the Los Angeles City Administrative Officer. They would have to go through the city council and the mayor, I believe, to get on the ballot. We'll find out if that happens. Meantime, Miguel Santana, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayLA or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
Hi, this is Warman Alney back with Which Way LA. Last summer, Los Angeles enacted an ordinance giving bicycle riders the chance to sue automobile drivers for threatening them, harassing them, or trying to force them off the street. Hit and runs are a big concern to cycling activists. KCRW's Avishai Artsy spoke to cycling activist Don Ward, who told this story.
My name's Don Ward. I'm a neighborhood councilman in Northridge. I'm also a co-founder of Midnight Riders and Wolfpack Hustle, which are group ride concepts in Los Angeles. So about 3 years ago, I was riding my bike up Glendale, right over there, and it was about 1 a.m, and as I'm riding, I'm looking back and signaling to get in the left turn lane. I see a car coming at me very fast. It was actually coming so fast that I got freaked out because it was swervy too. I sensed that this guy wasn't really looking for me and I tried to get out of the road. We both made a move for the right, slammed into me from behind. I remember falling into the hood, crushing the hood, and then being thrown about 50 feet. I was laying on the ground and my head happened to be facing towards the car as it drove around me. I've already had, at that point, a few friends get hit and run on. So I had the presence of mind to actually, look for the license plate because I just didn't feel like this guy was going to stop. I read the plate numbers, and I knew I was going to forget them, so I just kept repeating them, and I actually pulled out my phone while I was laying on the pavement and Twittered it, and just so I'd have a record of it. After all was said and done, I got out of the hospital. I called the police, you know, just to find out what's going on. I mean, here, I have the plates, all right, you know. You watch those cop shows when you're a kid and you see blazing sirens, you know, they're going to get the guy, you know, and I found the exact opposite. You know, it was like the voice on the other end of the phone was basically apathetic. Well, are you okay? Yes, I'm okay. You know, I'm not dead. So it sure hurts, but I'm all right. Well, it's going to take a couple weeks to run the plates, and you know, maybe you can drive around and look for the guy. Because I was kind of shocked to hear that, you know, a couple weeks to run the plates. It's a computer. It should be pretty simple. Turns out the police are so burdened with, you know, traffic incidents and so forth that I became just another case on the pile. So putting the word out there about the plate through Twitter and Midnight Riders, hours later, a person contacted me. He was a lawyer, and he had the plates run through a friend in the CHP who found a match about 2 miles up from where I got hit. We actually found where the car was getting repaired. I filmed the car getting repaired. We got all this evidence and brought it to the police about 3 days later. And once I saw the police station, I understood why these guys are not able to process cases quickly. I mean, the place was stacked with papers. The computers were, you know, something from out of the 90s. But this kind of thing needs to change, because if we can assume the reason why he took off was he was drunk, he made the right decision, because had he stayed, his license would have been suspended. He would have gone to jail. But instead, choosing to take off, he got a $500 fine and 30 days Caltrans. His license was not suspended. He was still driving on our roads right after that. And that's what's really frustrating, is that our laws in this state are really harsh and appropriately harsh for drunk drivers, but yet we do nothing for hit-and-run drivers.
Again, that was Don Ward speaking to KCRW's Avishay Artsy. Once again, the city of Los Angeles has adopted an ordinance designed to protect cyclists from that kind of thing. Sergeant David Krumer is the LAPD liaison to bicyclists. And, Sergeant, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Oh, absolutely.
Does that sound like a credible story to you?
Unfortunately, it does sound credible. I mean, I'd like to say that the policies now would be such that if we're presented with a license plate, we'd immediately run it. And if the person happens to be local, we might be able to send somebody out to actually catch the guy while he's pulling into his driveway. That's the way it's supposed to happen. And I can't, don't really know why it didn't happen in Don's case. But the way that it's supposed to work is that if somebody gives us a license plate and it just occurred, there's no reason why we can't run the plate, find out the address if it's someplace local within Los Angeles, to dispatch a car to see if the person happens to be there at that residence.
Are stations as burdened as Don Ward described?
Very burdened. There are so many traffic collisions every year within the city of Los Angeles that there's just not enough traffic investigators to adequately investigate every single instance. And as a result, there's a sort of a prioritization that occurs where basically, let's say that you had a hit-and-run incident, but it didn't result in injuries. Well, every collision that resulted in death, or every collision that resulted in serious injuries, all those would get priority before yours is ever looked at. So as a result, you're constantly being pushed back to the bottom of the pile by things that are deemed to be of a more significant nature.
How seriously is the department taking cyclists now that they seem to be increasing in number and now that this new ordinance is in effect?
The relationship between the department and cyclists has, I would like to say, significantly improved within the last few years. And the cycling community brought to our attention that they perceived that the Los Angeles Police Department wasn't being as responsive as they should be to their concerns. As a result, we created a bicycle task force where we meet regularly with leaders in the cycling community, and we try to work these issues out. And a lot of that's taken the form of training our officers and helping them recognize under what circumstances which actions they're supposed to be taking. So I'd like to say that it's better, but it's certainly not ideal, and there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
There is a story that may be familiar to some of our listeners, particularly those in the bicycling community, involving Susanna Schick, also known as Pinky Racer, who reportedly was chased down and struck by a white Lexus while she was riding in downtown Los Angeles. That's gotten a lot of attention, been reported in the papers. What can you tell us about that?
Unfortunately, a lot of misinformation has been put out there with regards to that case. While there may have been a confrontation between the occupants of the vehicle and Susanna prior to her actually sustaining her injuries, at the time that she actually sustained her injuries, the car was already out of the picture. Her particular collision was witnessed by two Newton police officers who actually observed the Lexus make a right turn, and shortly thereafter was when Tinky actually went down. She wasn't struck, according to the officers. Initially, they said that, you know, officers didn't respond, officers didn't take a report. In fact, we were the first ones on the scene. We were the ones that actually contacted the ambulance to have her transported to the hospital. And we were the ones that actually took custody of her bike, and these officers actually took the bike back to her apartment. Shortly thereafter, two detectives went out to interview her and ask her what occurred. And at that time, and keeping in mind that this, you know, she was probably in a lot of pain because of her injuries, and I don't necessarily know what medication she was under. But at that time, she didn't articulate that she was hit. She just said that, you know what, my wheel got wobbly, and the next thing I know, I'm face down on the pavement. Well, because she never said, well, I was struck, we proceed, and taking into consideration our officers' observations, we understood this to be, well, there is no collision. This is simply an issue where, you know, we're not sure how it happened, but somehow she went down, and this vehicle was not a factor, and that's how we proceeded. Now, shortly thereafter, my understanding is that her friend and the blogosphere started putting out information that, no, there was, in fact, a collision. And as a result of that, we decided to go out and re-interview her to make sure that we had the story straight. Maybe there were some omissions that were there the first time around. We did, in fact, send out two detectives to talk to her again. And she says that she's not sure that she was hit. She thinks that she may have been involved in the collision. But even then, it wasn't the kind of confirmation that we would basically readdress or reassess how it is that we're approaching this particular case. We have decided to, instead of call it an injury report, to proceed as a crime report, because if that's the allegation, that's how we'll proceed. But the only reason why we initially didn't do it as a crime was because of the observations that our officers had made and based on the statement that she had initially made.
In any case, she is still in ICU, Sergeant David Krumer, with the LAPD. Let me put this in context. This coming Sunday, Los Angeles will see its fourth Ciclavia. That's when 10 miles of city streets will be closed to cars and open to pedestrians, and especially bicyclists. Bobby Gada is program coordinator for the Los Angeles Bicycle Coalition. He's also board president of Ciclavia. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do you feel better about riding your bicycle in Los Angeles because of the ordinance passed by the council and because of the kind of concern we've just heard from Sergeant Krumer?
Well, I think the situation definitely has improved over the past couple of years because of the relationship that we now have with the LAPD. The anti-harassment ordinance is fairly specific, and it'll be interesting if it actually ever does come into use, because it allows for filing a civil suit, and you have to have, you know, a certain amount of evidence and stuff like that. But just to speak to my actual experience riding on the streets, it really, these hit-and-run cases are truly terrible, and, you know, I mean, they're terrifying, and it really keeps people from riding. But day-to-day, I really do not have that many bad interactions with drivers. It's actually pretty rare that I have someone yell at me or purposely cut me off, and really is not significantly worse than any other large city in the United States. And, you know, if you ride safely, there's a class from the League of American Cyclists about road cycling, about riding the street, where if the lane is too narrow to share with a car, you take the entire lane. You ride predictably, you signal your turns, you know, stop at stoplights and stop signs. And I feel actually much safer riding a bike than I do riding in a car at this point.
Let me go back to Sergeant Krimmer, again, the LAPD's liaison to cyclists. Are some of these confrontations sometimes started not by the drivers but by the cyclists?
It depends on what you mean by start. I mean, there are certainly times when a motorist inadvertently cuts off a cyclist or just due to inattention invades the cyclist space. And on occasion, cyclists, you know, sometimes react to that in a negative way and, you know, may do something like, you know, tap on the windshield or like tap on the side view mirror. And that could, you know, as a result, trigger a confrontation. But that's a very rare case. For the most part, both parties just kind of let it go and just kind of think, well, you know what, they should be more attentive next time around. But on occasion, yeah, that does occur.
So, Bobby Gatta, very quickly, the Ciclovia this weekend, just tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, so it's 10 miles of streets that are closed to cars, and it's open for people to do whatever you want. So it's for people to walk, families, people to bike in the street. It's fun, it's free, and it's really amazing to see all these people out there using public space and seeing L.A. in, like, in a whole new way.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. I want to thank you both for being with us, Bobby Gatta with Ciclovia and the Los Angeles County Bicycle Coalition, and Sergeant David Krummer with the LAPD. Good to have both of you with us. Good luck on Sunday.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com/whichwayLA or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find Which Way LA on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. It's been 20 years since the so-called Rodney King riots, America's worst civil disturbance of the 20th century. Which Way LA, this program, was begun in the aftermath of that event. We'll run a week of special programs on KCRW during the week before the 20th anniversary on April 29th. At five-year intervals since then, Loyola Marymount's Levy Center for the Study of Los Angeles has polled residents about their city. The latest results are in, and here's Professor Fernando Guerra, who directs the center. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
So you have surveyed extensively after 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and now 20 years since the riots. How do people feel overall? Has the attitude of Angelenos improved or not?
Yes and no. You know, one thing I do want to mention is that the Center for the Study of Los Angeles was established as a response to the riots. So not just Which Way LA, but a variety of different other institutions were established to help out. What we see in the current survey done in 2012, mostly in the month of February, is that Angelenos are a little pessimistic about the city, and that's mostly because of the economy and housing. When we drill down and take a look at race relations, they're actually much more optimistic about race relations than one would think, given the previous answer about their pessimism toward the city. And this is a unique finding. Typically in Los Angeles and most of urban America, when people are pessimistic, they're not only pessimistic about the economy, but quality of life issues and racial relations. Here, race relations is not driving pessimism, nor is the perception of crime driving pessimism. And so we're beginning in L.A., and especially at this particular point in time, dividing the view on race and crime from whether or not you think the city is going in the right direction.
So do people feel safer?
Yes, they do feel safer. We asked the question, do you feel safer than 20 years ago? And 38% felt safer, 30% felt not as safe, and about 27% felt the same. Interestingly enough, it didn't work that way along racial groups. Whites and Latinos felt safer, Asians about the same, but African Americans didn't feel as safe. So only 29% of African Americans felt safer, but 40% didn't feel safer than 20 years ago.
Back to your earlier point, did African Americans also feel less optimistic about race relations?
Yes, but not at the divide wasn't as large as it is with on other issues. So I would say that all Angelenos from all races feel better about race relations than they did 20 years ago.
One of the questions that always occurs, of course, is how likely is it that other riots and disturbances like those of 1992 will occur again? What did you find out there?
Well, that was, I think, a very optimistic response for the city of Los Angeles. So, like you said, we've asked this question in five-year intervals. In 1997, 61% of the residents felt it might be likely. That declined to 51% in 2002, to 48% in 2007, and now it's only at 41% in 2012. Now, that's still a high number, but you certainly see the decline in that. And one, you know, two major theories that could explain that. One is that, in fact, people just feel safer, or there's such a distance between now and when the riots happened 20 years ago, we put that out of our minds and don't really factor that in. But either way, perception tends to focus and lead to people's actions, and just people do feel more optimistic about race relations.
As you said, though, 41% under other circumstances would be a very big number of people who think we might see that kind of conflagration again.
Yeah, I mean, the some of the underlying causes of what occurred in Los Angeles, mostly economic depression. We were somewhat in a recession during that time. This recession is worse. So people picked that up, that you create economic instability, and that ends up creating social instability. I think the city is different than 20 years ago. The police department has been reformed. It looks a lot more like L.A. than it used to back in 1992. There's been a tremendous amount of political incorporation, but still we have a long way to go in terms of economic incorporation of many communities.
How did people feel about their own neighborhoods?
You know, that's always a fascinating thing. While they were pessimistic about the city as a whole, meaning in terms of it was going in the wrong direction, 53% of Angelenos feel their neighborhood is going in the right direction, and only 28% felt it was going in the wrong direction. And so what's interesting is if you take a look, we ask people about their neighborhood and the city as a whole. If you add up all the answers in terms of a neighborhood, you would get a much better response for the city as a whole, but you don't. And so people are still much more keen to their neighborhood, feel much more positive about their neighborhood than they do in terms of the city, and that cuts across all of Los Angeles.
All right. Fernando Guerra, professor at Loyola Marymount University, director of the Levy Center for the Study of Los Angeles, which began in the aftermath of the riots, as did this program. We'll talk to you again during our special programming the week before the anniversary, which we're setting at April 29th, a Sunday. Meantime, thanks for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page in a moment. There may be a drone in your future, like it or not, on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. We've all heard about drones used by the military against hostile forces, by law enforcement, and to patrol America's borders. The private uses of unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, are currently limited to 400 feet off the ground, within sight of the operator. But a mandate from Congress, signed by the president, is about to make drones a ubiquitous presence in civilian life. John Villasenor is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor of electronic engineering at UCLA. Welcome to our program.
How are you doing? Thank you.
Tell us, if you will, about this new requirement that the FAA integrate drones into American space. What does that mean? How soon is it likely to happen?
Well, this legislation was signed into law on February 14th, and it actually provides for two different classes of what it calls unmanned aircraft systems. One class is public unmanned aircraft systems, and that's legal speak for these systems operated, for example, by police agencies, fire departments, state police, the federal government, and the like. And then the second class is what are called civil unmanned aircraft systems, and that would certainly include, as you just mentioned a moment ago, drones operated by private entities. And for both of those classes of platforms, there's a complex set of overlapping deadlines of starting when the legislation was enacted and going all the way through late 2015. But the upshot is, by the end of 2015, the legislation does indeed provide for the integration of these drones into the national airspace system.
So that means that they would be flying around with airliners and cargo planes and private planes and helicopters and all the other things that that we see passing overhead.
Well, I think there will certainly be drones in the air, but the FAA is going to be extremely careful to make sure that we don't have drones flying in the landing path of airliners at LAX. So there will be I'm sure, very conservative rules governing the operation of unmanned aircraft systems, and I'm sure that, you know, maintaining safe operation of the for everyone sharing the airspace will be a big priority. But it is certainly true that we will see more unmanned aircraft in the future than we have in the past.
How difficult is it going to be to monitor drones if, in fact, as I understand is quite possible, they're very small?
Well, the term drone is an umbrella term that, as you say, really spans everything from business jet-sized aircraft, unmanned aircraft, all the way down to, in many cases, platforms that can literally fit in the palm of someone's hand. And it does indeed raise an enormous challenge if you can imagine tens of thousands of these things being operated by tens of thousands of people. And I'm sure there will be hiccups along the way.
Before we get to the private uses, what about the public uses by the police, by the fire departments, by the federal government? How useful, potentially, are drones to agencies like that?
Well, very, in a lot of very beneficial ways. For example, it is extremely expensive, of course, to have a full-scale human-occupied helicopter, but there are many police forces in this country that, which may not have the budget to have their own helicopter, but could certainly afford a drone, and a drone might be extremely valuable, in fact, even life-saving if there's, for example, a hostage situation and the drone is able to provide a view and give the police information they may not otherwise have. So there's really quite a, and they, also they're very useful for search and rescue. And there was actually even a case late last year where a predator was called in to help locate a person in North Dakota who was then arrested.
They also have been used, as I understand, to fly into hurricanes and try to check out what their dynamics are.
Yes, that has happened as well. There's really an almost endless list of generally extremely beneficial applications that are opened up by drones in many different areas.
Is the surveillance camera the most important piece of equipment on one of these devices?
I think it depends on the context, but certainly for the domestic use of unmanned aircraft systems, I think the imagery that is going to be captured from these higher up vantage points will certainly be the dominant application.
What about the public public perception created by the concerns about drones in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen and other places where they have become obviously very unpopular, although in those cases they've been used, of course, to kill people? That won't be the case in the United States.
Well, yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that even the U.S. military, the overwhelming majority of unmanned aircraft system used by the U.S. military is for surveillance and image gathering. It happens, of course, that these missile strikes are the things that make the headlines, but it's really almost always used for surveillance. And I think the same thing will happen. We will have surveillance use here. And of course, we're certainly not going to have the government putting missile-armed predator drones over U.S. soil and using them to shoot at people. So that I don't think we need to lose any sleep worrying about that.
I'm absolutely certain you're right about that. But when they're used for surveillance, that's once again when they get to be very small. What about the difficulty in seeing them and the concern that people might be under surveillance without knowing it?
It is a concern. I think it's important to keep that concern in the larger context of a digital infrastructure which really now tracks almost everything we do, cell phones, internet, smartphones, mobile apps, and so on. So drones don't add enormously to the amount of information that's now being collected about us, but they have the potential to capture information from unique vantage points. And there will inevitably be some privacy challenges and some very legitimate privacy concerns that we're going to have to deal with as it becomes easier for people to get this kind of information.
Okay, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. John Villasenor, once again, at the Brookings Institution and UCLA. There is a very large, very active, very excited private hobbyist concern with drones, if I can use that term in this context. I don't know if you want to be called drones or not, if they want to be called drones or not. Chris Anderson is one of those very involved in it. He's the editor of Wired Magazine, and he's founder of DYI Drones /3D Robotics. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, good to be here.
How'd you get into drones?
You know, I just started about 5 years ago with kind of messing around with my kids with things like Lego Mindstorms Robotics, which is kind of an easy way to get started with robotics and radio control planes. And it became clear that, that the necessary technologies of sensors and wireless and processors, et cetera, were now kind of available in smartphones and toys and everywhere else. And so we just started hacking together an autopilot, put it in a plane. It kind of worked. And you know, then I went down the rabbit hole and it's kind of gotten out of control at this point.
Into a wonderful new world. How is this different from the model airplanes that we see people flying around with little gas engines?
They haven't had gas engines for a while. It's thanks to they're mostly using high efficiency electrics and lithium batteries and all sorts of good technology from the computer industry these days. But the difference is that drones, as we define them, are capable of autonomous flight, which is to say they have an autopilot on board, and you don't have to fly them. You just click on you click on your laptop, you click on a map, and give it waypoints, and give it a mission, and tell it to take off on its own, and it executes the mission, and loiters, and looks down with the camera, does whatever you've told it to do, and then flies home by itself. So think of it as a plane with a brain, or increasingly these days a copter of some sort. Four-bladed, six-bladed, eight-bladed copters who have enough intelligence on board to fly by themselves. So they don't require piloting.
What sort of missions have you sent them on?
We just mostly do it for fun. We do photography and videography. We like posting videos of cool aerial views, etc. But we're mostly just fascinated by the technology, so we try to do sort of more and more challenging mission tasks of executing geometric patterns or special, automatic landings that are even smoother than before. So, we're really robotics hobbyists, we push the technology as far as it can go. We're limited by the FAA rules that were mentioned before, so 400 feet in visual line of sight. So we can't do a lot of practical work within that domain, but we can have a lot of fun.
How is that policed, the 400 feet and the visual line of sight?
It's not that there's FAA inspectors around. It's just that it's self-policed in the sense that we reinforce it constantly in our own community and to remind people that this is not just compliance with the regs, but also sensible from a safety perspective. What would happen is broadly if you broke it and something bad happened, if one of your drones went out of visual line of sight and you hurt somebody or you damage some property, that presumably your liability would go up because you violated the FAA regs.
How would it be traced back to you, though?
It might not be. It's really just a question of, if you went back to retrieve it and you found out that it had, broken a window, then, I suppose someone could then call the FAA and said that you'd been naughty.
Have there been any instances of people operating drones in order to spy on their neighbors?
It's interesting. I people always ask that. I don't know of any. There's lots of easier ways to spy on your neighbor than a complex aerial robot. And of course, putting cameras in remote control aircraft has been possible for 50 years. There's nothing new about cameras in aircraft. And your neighbors, of course, don't need a drone. You're within visual line of sight, so you can just fly it yourself. I don't know. I do know of examples where ranchers have used drones over their own property to look at, fence lines, et cetera. And there's probably been some cases where people have out there in the desert or in ranch territory, sent it over a neighbor's property to check that out. But, by and large, these are anecdotes, and I can't prove they actually happened.
And what you would do then is you would program into your computer the mission. Let us say you were going to go look at your fence on the ranch, and you use a map and sort of show it where to go, and then turn it on, and it just goes and does it and then comes home.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You use software that basically uses Google Maps, and you just click on the map, where you want it to go, and then you tell it what you want it to do there. Sometimes it just hit this waypoint and go to the next waypoint, or sometimes loiter here or point the camera, at a certain GPS location at the ground, or just loiter and waiting for further instructions. And so you just complete a mission, just click around the map and all the places you want it to go, and then you say go.
And mostly that you say they're four-bladed helicopters. How big are they?
You know, they can be any size you want. Typically, the four-bladed helicopters, which are called quadcopters, you know, tend to be about 2 feet in diameter. But people often use, you know, six blades, eight blades, even more. Depends on how big a camera you want to lift. They range in price from, I mean, you can buy a toy quadcopter called a Paraday R drone in an airport at Brookstones. It's not really a drone in that it's not capable of autonomous flight, but it does have the same sort of physical characteristics, and it's kind of an amazing piece of technology. You fly it with an iPhone.
What does it cost to do it right?
To do it right? You know, it depends what you mean by right.
To get something that'll go and check out the fence post, for example.
Yeah, that's about $1,000, I think, would be, wow, you know, all told. You can do it for less, you know, $500, $600. But we think $1,000 is probably a good target for sort of all the necessary equipment to do it in a relatively safe fashion.
How many people are doing it?
Well, our community, DIY Drones, it stands for Do-It-Yourself Drones, has about 25,000 members. We've sold about 10,000. My company, 3D Robotics, which makes the physical hardware, the autopilot, sold about 10,000 of them. So just as a kind of point of reference, there's more amateur drones than there are military drones in the United States. The military has about 7,000, and we know about 10,000 in the hands of amateurs.
Again, Chris Anderson is editor of Wired Magazine, founder of DIY Drones and 3D Robotics. I want to go quickly back to John Villasenor with the Brookings Institution and UCLA. There is talk, I have read, of drones that would be the size of hummingbirds or even drones that would be the size of flies. How far away are we from that?
Well, actually, we're pretty much there already. There's a company called AeroVironment, which is actually here in the Southern California area. And they have actually made a drone which weighs, if I remember correctly, it's actually less than an ounce, and it has a video camera and is capable of flying around. And it will not be long before there are indeed drones that are the size of a bumblebee and then a fly. And that just does that's the way these technologies evolve. If I could also very quickly just respond to something Chris said, you know, I couldn't agree with more with Chris that drones are not traditional model airplanes. There's a very big difference. Model airplanes are, you know, flown under user control,
sure,
whereas these drones do have this autonomous capability, and that's a very important distinction.
Before we get to concerns about them, what are the possible uses for those that are so small that they'd be the size of a fly or a hummingbird?
Well, you can let your imagination run wild. It could follow you unseen as you walk into the door of a room and settle into a corner and then start taking pictures of you, I guess, if there's really no end of imaginative applications. On the more positive side, you can imagine if there's some sort of a disaster relief scenario, it might be able to slip in between the cracks in a house in a flooded area and look around and see if there's anyone in there who needs to get rescued. So there's all sorts of interesting applications.
I assume you could go into a nuclear power plant if there were an accident and let the drone take the pictures.
Fukushima, it would have been very useful to have extremely highly capable drones slipping in and out and seeing what's going on.
Ryan Kalo is Director of Privacy and Robotics at Stanford Law School's Center for Internet and Society. He's also an incoming law professor at the University of Washington. His research focuses on the intersection of law and technology. And do they intersect here? Professor, good to have you on our show.
Good to be here.
What are some of your concerns?
My concerns have to do with the fact that as costs of surveillance go down, as John was alluding to, those surveillance activities could end up going up. And so you could see a lot more surveillance of a couple different kinds being done by law enforcement and potentially also by commercial or even personal interests.
Describe some of the concerns that you have.
Well, imagine that if you're a police force and you have suddenly have the ability to watch an entire neighborhood. Perhaps what you do is you set an autonomous drone to sort of rove around the neighborhood looking for infractions. Or maybe you decide that somebody just, you know, looks a little fishy, and what you decide is that you're going to follow that individual around the neighborhood and see what they do. You know, there are real potential implications for civil liberties, especially as the government starts to use these devices more and more.
What about being able to follow a potential suspect and perhaps prevent a crime?
Look, there's always going to be a good reason to deploy drones, and there's also good reason for police to have solid investigation tools. But there have to be limits. I mean, we can't just You know, for instance, we could have a rule that allowed people to follow you into your house on the view that we'd catch more crime if we could get access to the interior of the home. But we set limits in this society. And so the question is whether drones upset that balance that we've struck between our security and interests and our crime detection interests and people's civil liberties.
I think everybody listening can imagine what the potential abuses might be if you had a robot and an unmanned aerial vehicle the size of a fly. But tell us about what you think about some of the issues and how there might be enforcement of some sort of new privacy law.
Right. Well, you know, actually, I think that one good thing about the domestic use of drones, and there are many, I actually believe this is a potentially wonderful transformative technology, but one good thing is I think it's going to force a national conversation around privacy. And the reason that is because historically, privacy law has lagged behind developments in technology, right? I mean, we're still using a law from 1986, I believe, in order to govern the circumstances under which the government can get your electronic communications like your email. Now, think about, you know, back in the mid-80s, people were using Discman, and we hadn't invented the internet quite yet. And so there's always been this lag. And the thing is that I think people will, for once, be really deeply uncomfortable with the notion that there are these small or large robots flying around their cities in an effort to surveil them. And I think that's going to actually force us to reexamine some of the privacy law on the books, which today actually guarantee very little privacy, at least in public or from a public vantage.
Aren't there going to be a lot of people, though, who really want to get a hold of them?
Who really want to get a hold of the drones?
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
Well, absolutely. And look, these things are potentially very, very useful, not just to law enforcement, but to firefighters, to researchers. There's a lot of great applications. But, you know, I doubt we're going to see those nice, innovative, wonderful, beneficial uses if we don't get a handle on the privacy question first. Because, again, I think there's going to be a big public backlash, and you're already beginning to see it. There's just quite a number of consumer groups and others who are deeply invested in this question of pressuring the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, to look at the privacy repercussions of the deployment of drones by the government and by commercial interests. And unless we get over that hurdle, we're not going to get to all those benefits that we all see in these things.
Is the FAA required to take this into consideration by this law that was signed by the president on Valentine's Day, February 14th?
Not expressly. So the mandate is that they could develop a comprehensive plan to integrate non-government drones into the national airspace. And the things that they're going to be thinking about are whether drones can perform safely, you know, without hazard to the public or without compromising national security. That said, I don't see why the Federal Aviation Administration couldn't consider the primacy ramifications as well. And my concern is if they don't consider it, if that agency doesn't look at it, who will? Then we're left basically to the courts and perhaps to state law to place any limits on drone technology.
Ryan Calo, now at Stanford, soon to be at the University of Washington. Let's talk to somebody who is, in fact, employing drones for law enforcement purposes. Benjamin Miller is the unmanned aircraft program manager for Mesa County, the sheriff's office in Colorado. Benjamin Miller, it's good to have you on our program.
That's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Indeed. Tell us what sort of drones you have and what you do with them.
Well, let me paint just a quick picture here for you. We operate small electric-powered. One is a quad rotor, like Chris had mentioned before, and the other one is a fixed-wing aircraft, so an airplane. All of it fits in the back of a patrol car, we give training to a specific patrol deputy, and then we give them the equipment, and as they patrol, if they see the need to launch an aircraft to aid in one of their operations, they make the call to put that up.
What sorts of operations have they been most helpful for?
The operations that we've done in the past, our program is about 4 years old now and really operationally for about the last 2 years after we've overcome many of the significant restrictions that the FAA has in place. In the last 2 years, as far as missions that we've flown, most of it is aerial photography of crime scenes. We can fly a 12 megapixel still camera and take photos from the air. We can map crime scenes with those photos and reconstruct crime scenes. We've done some work with our local fire department and arson investigations and helping them look for hot spots in fires that they've had. We've done search missions, search and rescue missions for lost individuals. We've chased a couple of bad guys. We had an instance where an individual had attacked another with a knife and then ran off into the bushes, and so we put the system up as our SWAT team moved through the bushes looking for bad guy. We had that aerial perspective up above, giving some overwatch and providing a greater level of safety for our officers.
Is there any problem introducing the evidence you gather that way in court? Have you had any problems with that?
No, we haven't. You know, one of the things I'm most proud about our program is that we've done our due diligence in looking at the Fourth Amendment and search and seizure laws as pertains to aerial searches. And what we found is that basically if you're in an area and you have that legitimate expectation of privacy, something that the courts would support, we can't fly below 400 feet and look into that area that you have a legitimate expectation of privacy. You know, the common term would be you're in your backyard and you have a privacy fence up to the point where if I'm standing on the street or we're driving by, we can't see into your backyard. If we fly below 400 feet, the courts pretty much, based on some case law that's out there and has been developed over time based on the use of police helicopters, with police officers in the helicopters, that case law really says that if you're flying below 400 feet from that vantage point, then there probably is still a legitimate expectation of privacy. And in that case, that operation would be deemed a search, and we'd need to go get a search warrant from a judge.
Benjamin Miller, again, Unmanned Aircraft Program Manager for the Mesa County Sheriff's Office in Colorado. Let me go back to Ryan Kahlo at Stanford, soon to be at the University of Washington. Do you hear anything from Benjamin Miller and the way that they're using their drones in Mesa County that concerns you?
Well, first of all, just a fine point about the law. There's really never been a case that has challenged the notion that you could fly below 400 feet. That was actually sort of an aside comment that a concurring justice made in a Supreme Court case. I mean, think about the precedent here. You have a situation where officers were flying a helicopter and they looked through two missing roof panels in a greenhouse. Right, these were just panels that just happened not to be there. And looking through the roof panels, they were able to see that marijuana was being grown. And the Supreme Court held that they didn't need a warrant for that. Right, and so I think that you could do quite a lot with a drone without a warrant. And this cost issue, I think, is really important. So, you know, maybe a smaller force can't have a helicopter, but they can have a drone. And once they have a drone, what's to stop them from, say, flying it around one neighborhood at a time to figure out who has a pool that's not licensed under the city's rules? And the idea is that, again, as the cost of surveillance goes down, the desire, the will, the taste for surveillance is inevitably going to go up. And the question is whether the Constitution and state law will adapt to that situation.
Well, that's all the time we have for this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Thanks very much to all of our guests. Which Way L.A. was produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Katie Cooper, and Andrea Brody. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can visit the Which Way L.A. blog for even more stories about Los Angeles at kcrw.com/WhichWayLAblog. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way L.A. is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.